Paraguayo.
Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are so happy to be joined in the studio by April Martin Chartrand, fiber alchemist, award-winning artist who has exhibited throughout California and throughout the country. And she has a really wonderful exhibit. Unfortunately, it's closing tomorrow, so hopefully you're in town and available to go check it out either today or tomorrow. It's entitled Treasured Cigar Box, Assemblage Exploration of the African Diaspora, and it's at the San Francisco Public Library in the African American Center, which is on the third floor there. And today, Wednesday, the library is open until 8 o'clock, and tomorrow as well, so you have a long time, you know, like you can go and you can just hang out in the Afro-American wing. take your friends, take your children, because those boxes, oh my goodness, they are just so intriguing and so interesting and just sort of literally take us back. Welcome to the show, April. Thank you so much for getting up early in the morning to talk to us,
Wanda,
about this fabulous, oh my goodness, wonderful exhibit. And I was wondering, before we talk about this work, and I'm not going to read your artist statement, I think I'll let you just tell us about it. Where the term alchemist, a fiber alchemist, and you've been on the show before because you're also a writer, a poet, you know, you write other types of, modes and things like that. Where fiber alchemist, where does that description of yourself come from?
Well, I had looked at some of the ancient chemical transforming of, like, base metals and turning things into gold. And, you know, back in the day, there was tons of African and European alchemists that would, you know, melt down minerals and make it into beautiful objects. And so fiber, because I use fiber and I change the substructure of fiber when I was doing that type of work, I can take fabric and then use a two-part hard resin, then use steam on the resin, and what happens, the fabric, like a piece of cotton, can actually take the form of a leathery, hard substance. So that's what the combination of fiber and alchemist came through.
Wow. Interesting, yeah. Wow, and you mentioned to me that you're going to actually be working on a postgraduate degree, right?
Not post. Well, it'll be a graduate degree.
Yeah.
Right. I have my BA from San Francisco State University in Creative Arts. Took off many years and to do other things, but then went back to get all of my undergraduate requirements that I that weren't in place when I graduated. Things like math, statistics, which was really a hard class, and all your undergraduate psychology classes. So, excuse me, that's what I'm doing now. I'm getting my master's, attempting to get my master's degree.
Mm-hmm. In psychology?
Yes, counseling psychology, yes.
Wow, yeah. So this Treasure Cigar Box series invites you, you write, into a world of the global slave trade perspectives between Africa, Europe, the Americas, and America, United States of America, that is. And these multidimensional assemblage cigar boxes incorporate recycled and found objects, keys, money, and hand-painted paper. And you say the series bridges a historic gap by connecting the major colonial slave trade shareholders and their cultivation of tobacco products in the New World, the larger European crown's constitution monarchy, which expanded their empires were Portugal, Spain, France, Britain, England, Dutch, Netherlands, and America. And these countries established global trading companies, built fortified harbors and trading settlements along the coastlines of the African continent, Goree, St. Louis, Elmira, and Cape Coast. For example, the French East Indian Company was one of the first such Gold Coast corporations. All of these countries traded in various commodities and parceled out newly colonized territories through the triangular trade system, West Africa, Caribbean, Americas, and Europe. The Treasure Cigar Box series offers knowledge and research into the deeper meaning of how the exploitative practices of the brutal servitude of the American slaves reaped fortunes for the colonizers. And finally, the planting and harvesting of tobacco by African enslaved persons fueled the beginnings of the modern-day global corporations. And what's really wonderful about these boxes is how, you know, the way you make them, they actually, the way you create them, they look really, you know, rich and valuable within themselves. I mean, gold and the money and the way you have them depicted. So I wonder if you could talk to us about where this idea came from and how you happened to, you know, because I believe you have 18 in total, how you came to make the individual box, and we can talk about some of them specifically that I'm really interested in for our audience.
All right, just an overview. I had started collecting cigar boxes many, many years ago, at least a decade ago, and I liked them because they were beautiful. I mean, I thought they were works of art within themselves. And after some time, something spurred me on to actually read the labels to find out where these companies were from. And also, when I looked on the origin of the tobacco, a lot of them were for the triangular trade system. And after seeing a few movies and what have you on who was actually the slaves that were producing them, was basically indigenous people were forced to, you know, make this these cigars and things of that nature and cultivate the tobacco on the various plantations throughout the Americas and also part of America, United States, as it is now. So I started kind of thinking I need to kind of do more research about this and find out how all this came about. And as a result of my researching it, I understood very clearly that the whole catalyst for the slave trade came as a result of a lot of the Europeans wanting to have a tobacco so they can kind of go in their little world of altered state, as well as them cultivating and harvesting other products such as rum, sugar, and also they wanted to increase their land holdings. So that's what spurred me to start making these boxes.
And also, I thought it was really interesting when we were talking yesterday that you've actually visited some of the places that are depicted, you know, in these boxes. For instance, you reference Brazil, and you've actually been there, and you reference you don't necessarily reference. I mean, that's sort of a part of the Caribbean, but you reference or South America, but South America, Caribbean are connected. The Latin diaspora. But you also referenced me. You've been to Argentina, and you've been to, I believe, Mexico, right?
I've been to Mexico and St. Thomas, which is in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to Iguazu, which is borders Brazil and Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
And that's despite a major massacre by the Portuguese and the Spaniards. I don't know if people saw the movie The Mission with Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro. I actually saw the area where they had a major catastrophe, where they had basically murdered, and with a form of genocide, they had murdered the indigenous people right on the border of Argentina and Brazil. And I went to that mass body of water called the Iguazu. And it was really amazing, just amazing, that I didn't understand the connection until decades later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk to us about this actual, you know, assembling of these works, these many works, these smaller works that are part of a larger work, because most of the items, I believe you said, some of them, most of them are found objects, but some aren't. And you have, like, reoccurring objects, like you have keys, you've got pennies and other types of money that might be associated with the place. Like, for instance, when in your piece that looks at Haiti and the successful slave revolt there, and you talk about Toussaint in your description of the piece, you've got, you know, some Haitian money. And also another reoccurring sort of item are the mirrors and the boxes sit on the mirrors, and also you have like little pieces of mirrors and some African symbols like the indinkras and other types of things. What if you could talk about the actual you know, the parts of the box, you know, where these things come from. Maybe we'll talk about a box in particular. What about three queens? I really, really like that one because people don't necessarily think about those three queens, the European monarchy, and I thought that was a pretty powerful box.
Yeah. Okay. Well, how I make the boxes, I basically collect a bunch of stuff. I'll be on the street. I'll collect different items that you see, different computer parts. I've actually bought the pennies and that part of the money. However, a lot of my friends who've traveled were giving me tons of foreign coins from the Philippines to all of Europe to South America and also Canada. I actually had some friends bring me a bunch of Canadian money. And also I had even money from Israel, but I couldn't really use that because there was no connection to what I was doing. So I just collect things, and sometimes I'll go to Cliffs, and they give me tons of keys for free. And in terms of the boxes, I was collecting them for free. However, I needed to pay for their wooden ones because they're a little bit more expensive. So I basically just collected a bunch of stuff, and I was able to kind of come up with a theme. The heart was basically people who do this somehow have lost their heart, and the key is opening the door up. I use locks on pretty much all of my insides of my boxes. So I have keys and locks, and that whole idea of once you have a key, you can free yourself, and those who hold the key put locks on those who are indentured. Mm-hmm. So that was an intense theme for me. The other theme was about money, the whole commerce and building of empires back in the 1600s, how that was about land grabbing and taking people's lives and using technology of the guns and the powder and gunpowder and horses and ships, using their new technology to decimate the native peoples because our technology was different, not inferior, but just different. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to use that as kind of a way of thinking about how things came about. And the other key thing is the mirrors. The mirrors for me, it's about looking at yourself. And once you know this information about our history, the underbelly of things that they don't teach you in school, things you've been informed about, how do you then look at yourself and deal with it? And how do you keep that sense of denial once you have this information? And that's what the mirrors are about. And also the underparts of my pieces are decorated as well. You can't see them really well until you lift them up, but the under mirror can show parts of it. And so the mirrors are to reflect the piece back to you, and looking at the piece, you'll see parts of yourself as you're looking through each piece.
We were talking about, you know, sort of the emotional and psychological effect of this type of art has on its maker. And you mentioned how, you know, when you were sort of like in the space, or you were like, you'd make these boxes, and it would take, you know, you'd work through lunch and through dinner, and just, it would just be, you know, you'd be in like a creative zone. And then you also talked about how for some of them, you know, the energy and the spirits that you were channeling sometimes overwhelmed you. And one of them we talked about, I was just, you know, for me, when I was walking around to the various display cases, when I got to the one, the slave ship baby jumpers, what you have there, you say Portugal, France, Spain, Britain, Netherlands, Dutch, Germany, and the United States of America, triangular trade, and then the history is, you could talk about the history of that, but it was like, oh my goodness, and then that was one that made me like stop, and I had to like sit down for a minute. So maybe you could talk about sort of, because this is a spiritual. It's not just making art, you know, oh, this is going to be pretty. You know, this is our history. This is personal. Talk about, you know, being an artist and being, you know, part, like, okay, you've got the subjective aspect and you've got the objective, and how sometimes that's, it's not easy to be objective when you are subject.
Right. Well, the thing is, I basically wanted to know about who we are as a people and who we are as a global nation. And all the places that tied me together had increased intense history, and the same thing plays out in every place I've been, outside the country and within the country. And for me, as an artist, to start researching and getting to the underbelly of what I think I've been told is a daunting task. Because I'm using references to places that most people may not know about. You have to go deep into your study, go deep into maybe NPR and some of the, you know, KQED stuff that they'll show you that's in their archives. Then you have to go into the books and places that are not on your shelves in your normal school settings, and reading people like Howard Zinn, listening to people like Timothy Weiss, who is an incredible speaker on white denial and xenophobia. And listening to their works, going to their lectures, and taking that all in, and then having to sit with it, and then having the nightmares and the dreams and the spirits talking to you can be very daunting. Then comes the process of trying to develop a piece. So when I develop a piece, I have a lot of history with me. I have a sense of where I want the pieces to go. But once I'm in the zone, I have no clue what's going to happen because I don't draw my pieces. I take from an inspiration event, you know, some kind of documentary, and begin the process of developing the piece. And as I said, you talk about the zone. Sometimes when I start developing, I dovetail on an insight. Then something wells up in me, and I begin to create a piece that makes a lot of sense. And then I reference it back to history again. So there's times when I lose myself in the piece. I become the piece. Or maybe one of my ancestors that I know about is speaking to me, and I basically sometimes can't handle it. I have to put the pieces down, put them away, and may not. One of my pieces, I stopped working for 2 years because I emotionally could not deal with my pieces speaking to me. So that's, and part of another piece that I want to talk about specifically is the slave ship baby jumpers. I was inspired by a writer, Miss Harrington, who's a playwright in the city. She wrote a play on bitter fruit, and in that she talks about jumpers. Then I start researching what jumpers really were, and as some people don't know, a lot of African slaves decided to jump off the slave ship instead of being slaves in whatever country they were being sent to. Also, another piece I had was called The Baby Spirits of the Middle Passage, Ocean Jumpers, and I did a piece with a baby shoe with a lot of little babies on it, all crusted in gold, and that piece came from that same inspiration from reading and going to this play. And what I understood about the jumpers, some people say, well, committing suicide is a sin, blah, 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 Well, if you know you're going to be being held up in a slave ship, no air, no nothing, and you're vomiting on each other, you're killing each other because you're trying to, you're suffocating, I don't think people want to live that way. And, you know, that's just not the way to treat people. So as a result, a lot of the jumpers, when they were allowed to be on top of the, to get, you know, air and be washed down like animals, they end up throwing their babies off the ship or either themselves. And some of them even had mutiny. So one of the key things I found out about the slave ships, the sharks were in on the action too. They basically followed the slave ship because there was such a major blood trail in the Atlantic Ocean that they were sniffing blood and they were following the wave of each ship and they were taking the bait as people jumped off. That was pretty intense for me to kind of take in. And I ended up writing a poem about the bloody waters of, you know, my ancestors and upholding a sense of dignity at that point, compared to an artist, you kind of fall apart. You know, your dignity and your sense of who you think you are is being shattered as you're creating these pieces. So I don't want to go on too much more about it, but that's what those two pieces were about.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, other pieces, you know, are, you know, like looking at the neo-slavery, you know, sort of showing, you know, your audience that, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't end slavery because to a certain extent, you know, black folks are still slaves. And then other people are slaves to other things. I mean, we could all say that, you know, freedom is something that's more than just a physical act or a legislative act, that it's something, you know, in we're looking at sort of a global commerce that people are being bought and sold all the time.
Yeah.
And don't even know that they're on the market. Don't even know that, you know, that people are, you know, have shares in them unless they think about it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, the piece that I did on the new technology of slave ships kind of relates back to the piece that I wrote, that I did on the three queens. I think those two pieces go together because of the colonial aspect of land. I call it land grabbing. Mm-hmm. And for instance, in Spain, Queen Isabella, you know, sponsored Christopher Columbus in his expeditions, and as a result, people of color, or indigenous people that were that engaged with Europeans, a lot of them died because they could not handle but they were not ever exposed to the various diseases or biology of their captors. So in a way, that was a major genocide. Every place they went, there was a major genocide happening through biology or through brutal warfare. And so because the queen decided to increase their offshore holdings, you know, their actions spurred the golden age of exploration, which I call exploitation and colonization. And then so for me, the new technology piece deals with the colonizers and the people that came from the, you know, British and the, you know, Portugal and Spain. They had technology that the indigenous people did not have, nor did they want to have that because it wasn't part of their landscape. So if you're taking guns and gunpowder and you're bringing horses and you're bringing ships that are highly, you know, can hold tons of people, and you're using this level of technology, you're going to overthrow people because they haven't been exposed to that. And in some instances, a lot of the natives thought they were gods or they thought the animals were parts of an anthropomorphic rendition of some kind of god. So they were in awe some of the time. And so how are you going to fight bows and arrows with gunpowder and guns? So that technology is happening today with all this technology in terms of, you know, phones and computers and people working in industry where a lot of people of color, unless you're maybe, you know, East Indian and you're from those countries that have a high level of commerce and, you know, kind of a sense of high level of, I guess, what would you say, stratification in their society, because you're the ones that are on top are the ones who have the best education, so they're a part of the whole deal as well. So they're being used as pawns because they're being used as pawns by our government to create technology for us to kind of become a larger world power. So people that think they're kind of engaging in a way are being, you know, utilized as pawns and, you know, worker bees to make these larger corporations like the IMF and things like that more money.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, yeah, people kind of have to think about who they are and how they play themselves in this whole world of, you know, trade and buying and stock markets and things of that nature. So that's where the technology piece comes in.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah, and some of the other boxes that were really intriguing and interesting, they all are actually, and I really like the way that you have them, you know, situated next to each other. I think they're, and for the most part, there are about three in each case, and then in one where you have the one with the, I don't know if it's the baby jumpers. It's the one where they have the, where you have the skeletons.
Oh yeah, that that piece I had an idea because after I saw the heard this play by Miss Harrington, I had vivid imagery of skeletons at the bottom of the ocean, which is, you know, basically the ocean is kind of a massive graveyard for African peoples. And I basically wanted to use a piece to depict ocean and babies and large adult skeletons, as well as the raping of Africa through the elephants and the elephant tusks. So, and also I used shells from the ocean. And so I basically wanted to tell a story of the jumpers and how this actually looks. These skeletons that are painted with gold. The whole idea of painting them gold was about their value and how they were devalued and how they were transported here. But once they got here, they became gold for all these people to make tons and tons of money for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then it's interesting how you juxtapose the devalue of people of African descent and juxtapose that with African Queen, you know, Africa being the birthplace of humanity, and
yeah.
Human cargo that up that box, you know, where you talk about the origin of a Homo sapiens, and
right.
You know, and the skull that was found, and you bring it to California, you bring it to Berkeley.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about that a minute?
The African Queens, I had been listening to Dr. Spencer Wells. He's one of the top American geneticists and anthropologists. He authored the book Journey of Man, A Genetic Odyssey. He's also had a PBS special about the origins of man. You can see most of it on YouTube. And he goes all the way back. He connects all these people from all over the world back to Africa. He shows how people came out of Africa, how the continents were once one, and how they kind of walked over these various continents that are now separate. And everyone, he did blood testing on every one of those folks from all the way from Asia to Philippines to parts of Europe and parts of Canada. And all of them have some chromosomal, contact where you could see you can follow the Y chromosome all the way back to this one typical chromosome that everyone seems to have. Like people who look white and people who look Asian or whatever these kind of social constructs that they've developed of what you're supposed to look like based on this whole construct, everyone kind of are related. And they found this white couple that didn't realize that they had origins in Africa. They went all the way to parts of the Philippines, and they were linked by this chromosomal component. So I had been listening to him and looking at the whole notion of race, which is not even real. Based on biology, you can't determine who is who, and we all have the same 24, and how we physically come out, which is phenotyping, is based on whatever chromosome decides to connect. And also this gentleman, Timothy White, I read an article about his research, and then I figured out, okay, 160,000 years ago, you know, we all came out of this place. And so therefore, there's some kind of connection here because there's only one species, which is a human species. So how can you kind of delineate people out by so-called phenome typing and make that a race when we all have the same 24 chromosomes?
Yeah, but also this doctor, Mr. Tim White, a paleontologist, he's at the University of California, Berkeley, and he found these skulls in Ethiopia, which is in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so that part of it was tricky because that dovetailed on what, Dr. Spencer Wells was talking about. So that piece, I wanted to make kind of like an African face. I actually used my own hair. I cut off hair, my dreadlocks. And also, I had tooth surgery during that time. I was really, really sick. I became so sick because I had so many root canals, whatever. I actually took parts of my teeth and put them inside of the piece of the top of the face. So part of my being are in these pieces based on my whole trauma and my illness. With, I had a whole year of tooth problems that were pretty acute and very painful. So I decided to cut my hair and throw pieces in there. So you can't really tell because I painted over things and I glossed over things with different mediums. But, yeah, I had to put myself in the pieces, too, because I had to kind of transmute my own pain that I was going through.
Wow, that sort of takes me to my next, my next guest is late, so that's good.
Because
I got another question to ask you, and I want to let our audience know that we're going to continue this conversation next week. It's going to be a part two to this great conversation. But you need to go see the boxes so you can, these treasure cigar boxes, because next week when we talk, the exhibit will be down. So you need to get over to the San Francisco Main Library, which is on Larkin. You get off at the Civic Center Bar Station and say, okay, I want to go to the Main Library. Which exit should I take out of here? And you'll come up and you'll be right there and you cross the street because the exhibit is up only through tomorrow, which is Thursday, August
2nd. And I'll be there, too. I'll be there from 6 to 7:30.
Oh, today?
No, I'll be there Thursday, tomorrow, the last day.
Oh, really?
I'll
be there. Nice.
Yeah, I'll be there tomorrow. So if people want to come and meet me, they can come. Be there at 6 to 7:30 on Thursday.
Okay.
And also, if people can't make it, I have a video of most of it is up on YouTube. So you can just Google my name or, once you get to YouTube, put my name in it and put cigar boxes as maybe another search. And you can see them. I designed a video that tells you a little bit about the pieces that I have. I think I put up at least 10 pieces in this video.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. But you want to go, if you're in town, go to the museum, go to the library and see them for yourself. If you're not in town, if you're out of town, you're listening in, from other places in the country and in the world, then okay, we understand. So my next guest is in the studio. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about the Sheikha da Silva, but we don't have time because that's a long story, so we'll talk about that next week. But I wanted you, in closing, to talk about your own family history and just sort of, this whole idea of, of looking at the history of Africans in America and then the diaspora and these treasure cigar boxes, which are treasures. I mean, these are our people. These are our stories. So that's definitely a treasure, and these are treasures, and like most treasures, that need to be excavated, and we're really happy that you have excavated these stories, 15 of them on display and 18 that you've been working on. And who knows, maybe you might have some other, treasures coming out in this form, who knows, in the future. But I wanted you to, in closing, to talk about your own journey in your own family history, because I believe that this idea of excavation came from a personal excavation that happened in your family around your finding, about who your people are.
Yeah. Well, my family really never talked about anything. All I knew is that, we had people that were white in our family. No one ever said anything. No one really ever told me why, they landed in Georgia. Well, a cousin of mine that got a hold of me through email in 1993 or 4 or something like that, told me he was doing a family tree and using our pictures and our history to put in this whole book. So it turned out, I find out that our family started with Charity Ann, who was a Native American woman who was in Virginia, which is the highest tobacco producing state, with the other ones in Georgia. And she was taken by Mr. Parker Sr. and grabbed and taken, not sold, but grabbed and taken, and brought back to his plantation in Georgia. And he had a son, Parker Jr., and she was given to him as his concubine, and they stayed together until death. He went to the Civil War, even though he left her there. When he got back, part of his children, she had 18 children with this man, part of her children were sold off as property. When I got the manifest from my cousin, he went through the records and found the inventory list of, you know, rakes and hoes and various, you know, other, you know, kind of like basic land towing tools. The children and her were on this list. My cousin sent it to me. I was in my car. I remember this day so vividly. I opened the letter. I went through the inventory list. I just started screaming and crying. It just, that ugly cry, you know, that howling cry. I don't know. I have no idea why that came about, but it felt like a primal scream of how dare you kind of thing. So that is part of my family history. Then I had an opportunity to go back to Georgia in 96. Thank you, Alonzo King, for my my ticket. Alonzo gave me a ticket to go back to Georgia to my family reunion. And I went to my Charity Ann's gravesite because my cousin, who's a genealogist, collected money to redo her gravesite because it was in shambles. So we went to the small part of Georgia called Forsyth. And on this little, you know, rickety kind of like country church, there was all of my family buried in this gravesite. I walked to the gravesite. I don't know what happened to me. I felt people jumping out of the grave. I was singing church songs I haven't sung in years and decades, things I would not have remembered. If you asked me now to sing those songs, I couldn't do it. I was in the church singing, and I felt like I was a different person. So that's kind of what helps inspire some of these pieces, because I had that intense history of slavery, Jim Crow, saw where my folks lived. Across the street, there were these beautiful mansions where they lived, were rickety shacks, no bathroom, no running water, holes in the floors. It was scary to see Jim Crow in action.
Wow, yeah.
So what we think we know, we don't really know.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that's my part of my history that spurred some of my poetry. It spurred kind of doing some of these pieces along with the history that I've uncovered through, you know, the cigar boxes.
Right, yeah. Well, thank you so much, April, for joining us this morning. You know, there's much more we could talk about, but people need to get over to the San Francisco Main Library, third floor African American Center, and see these treasured cigar boxes and meet you on Thursday from 6 to 7:30 at the closing of this wonderful exhibit. And again, we're going to continue our conversation next week, and we'll talk about some of the books that I checked out, because there are some great books that you can look at right there in the center that are on reserve, and then you can go in the collection and find them. And so I struggled with 8 books I checked out on African American history and freedom and, you know, and the slave trade and all that kind of stuff on BART on my way back home, inspired by your exhibit.
Oh, that's so cool. I'm so glad.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right.
Take good care.
So
all right.
I appreciate everything. Bye-bye.
Bye. Good morning, Ramona. How are you?
I'm good, on the move. How you doing?
Oh, I'm good, thank you. Oops, lost you there for a second. Oh, there you are.
Okay.
Yeah, I was wondering, do we want to, I could introduce you first, and then we could play the commentary that Mumia recorded on the 29th. You want to do it that way?
I'll leave it up to your expertise.
Oh, you're so kind. I like your introduction of yourself in Redefining Black Power, Reflections on the State of Black America, edited by Joanne Griffin, which we talked about, I guess that might have been, I think that was earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, you say, I'm Ramona Africa. I'm Minister of Communication for the MOVE organization. I was a former political prisoner of 7 years, and I am the sole adult survivor of the police bombing of the MOVE organization that took place in May 1985. I am also a representative of the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. But more importantly, I am a revolutionary. And maybe you could talk to our audience before we get to what, really important reason for our call. And also, this is Black August. This is the first day of Black August. Maybe you could talk about, what it means. What do you mean when you say I'm a revolutionary? What is a revolutionary?
Well, a revolutionary is a person that refuses to accept wrong, no matter who it's coming from, no matter how it's packaged, a person that stands up for what is right. A revolutionary is someone that understands the complete and total meaning of revolution, understands that it's not just fighting cops, fighting judges, district attorneys, etc. It's fighting the whole entire system that is oppressing us through poison in our water, poison in our food, poison in the air. It's fighting the racist next door, fighting the mentality of racism. It's the whole picture. It's fighting oppression and slavery, imprisonment, whether it's on a human level or what we see as an animal level, because if you make an allowance for an animal to be abused, mistreated, enslaved in zoos, circuses, etc., then you don't believe in the principle of freedom. You've compromised it. So a revolutionary is a person that understands these things and that lives the principle of revolution, doesn't just talk it, lives it, is the example of the principle of freedom, So that is what, a revolutionary is to me.
Right, yeah, and I, from what you just said, it seems as if, MOVE and in this whole idea of what it means to be a revolutionary and the whole notion of freedom, that the idea of the organization and also the idea of all of us or none is one that you have embodied, from the beginning.
Exactly, and it's what's earned us the wrath of industrialists, all of these people.
So a week from now, August 8th, it marks the 34th anniversary of the unjust imprisonment of the MOVE 9. And you called me last week, I believe, and told me, that there are some various actions that you would like supporters to participate in to try to get your family out of prison. So if you could talk a little bit about what happened 34 years ago, and maybe tell us who are the MOVE 9, because I know if there's not 9 anymore, that you've lost
a
family.
Sister, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, briefly, the MOVE 9 are 9 of my MOVE sisters and brothers who were attacked in 1978, on August 8th of 1978, in a warlike fashion under the administration of Mayor Frank Rizzo, a known racist, a known brutal cop who worked his way up through the ranks to become mayor. And my family was attacked allegedly because they had not vacated our home. Rizzo and the city administration wanted my family out by August 1st, according to them. And when my family had not vacated, this was supposed to be the basis of the attack. But police officials from Philadelphia had gone down to Richmond, Virginia, where two of my sisters had been reassigned to, and they arrested them and brought them back to Philadelphia. So obviously the issue was not our home and move people not vacating our home, because people, move people that were not even there, were sought out, hunted down, and arrested and brought back to Philadelphia. But anyway, on that date, August 8th, in the wee hours of the morning, thousands of cops came out to our home armed for war and attacked my family, men, women, pregnant women, babies, shot thousands of rounds of bullets, pumped tons and tons of water in our basement where everybody was at, men, women, children, our animals, you know, our dogs and cats, et cetera. And they used the fire department to help, yeah, by, you know, using their water cannons to pump all this water in the basement, like 6 feet of water. And when the smoke cleared, because they had pumped tons of tear gas in the basement as well, when the smoke cleared, a police officer had been shot. And, of course, there was no way that was going to turn out except for them to say family shot and killed this cop, James Ramp. And that's what they did, even though the evidence showed that there's no way my family could have shot him. Everybody was in the basement, even by police own admission. They stated that everybody was in the basement. They had gone from the third floor of the house, second floor, first floor, and determined that everybody was in the basement. The cop that was shot with the bullet traveling on a downward angle. How could somebody in the basement shoot somebody standing like 6 feet above them on street level with the bullet traveling on a downward angle? And then to add insult to injury, within an hour or two of arresting all of my family members, what they did was sent a demolition team out and completely demolished our home, move headquarters, but more importantly, the scene of the crime, vital evidence in the murder of a police officer. Why would they demolish MOVE headquarters if they really thought that MOVE people killed the cop? I mean, you know, and I think everybody knows, that if they really believed that, then they would have preserved every bit of evidence they could get their hands on. They would not destroy it. They would do everything that they thought they could do to prove that MOVE people killed the cop. Then my family went to trial, and it was not a jury trial. It was what they call a bench trial, meaning a trial by the judge alone, not a jury. And my family chose this. They chose to have a bench trial rather than a jury trial. And people that hear that say, why in the world would they do that? Why wouldn't they want a jury? Well, I would say that maybe 90, maybe even 95 or 99% of people in prison had jury trials, you know? MOVE people were not going to allow this government, this system, to excuse their railroad of MOVE people by saying, well, they had a trial by a jury of their peers. It wasn't the system that put them in jail. It was, you know, 12 people, a jury of their peers, that we weren't going to let them do that. The judge is supposed to be learned in the law. It's supposed to be objective. This is what they tell people and everything. So we were putting the burden of this whole thing on that judge. And after sitting through the entire trial, Judge Edwin Malmet convicted 9 of my sisters and brothers of murder, third-degree murder, and conspiracy, which is a contradiction, oxymoron, because if he's saying they conspired to kill James Ramp, then wouldn't that be first-degree murder?
Mm-hmm.
If they planned it, they conspired to do it, you know? But he convicted them of third-degree murder and conspiracy and several counts of assault and gave them a sentence of 30 to 100 years in prison. A day or no more than 2 days after sentencing my family, Judge Edwin Malmet went on a radio talk show, the Frank Ford talk show here in Philadelphia. And Mumia Abu-Jamal, who had sat through a lot of the trial of the Movenon, he heard Judge Malmet on the radio, so he called in. And he asked Judge Malmet a simple question. Who killed Officer Ramp?
Oh, yeah. Let's play the
okay.
Play this commentary now.
Okay.
Memories of Malmet. You know, it's been over 30 years since our conversation, yet I remember it like yesterday. That's partly because, unless you're a lawyer, it's rare to talk to a judge, even if you're a reporter, as I was. But mostly, I remember it because it took place on the air during a live broadcast of WWDB-FM's Frank Ford Show. Judge Edwin Malmet, an elderly man, had recently sentenced 9 members of MOVE to 30 to 100 years on a third-degree murder conviction of a Philadelphia cop. Judge Malmet had a distinct reputation for fairness, unlike a lot of his companions on the bench. He spoke softly and seldom seemed to lose his temper. I called in and asked him a simple question. Who killed James Ramp, the cop? The judge answered, on the air, mind you, I haven't the faintest idea. I was so dumbfounded that I didn't think I asked a follow-up question. I just heard a judge who had just sent 9 people to prison for a century say that he hadn't the faintest idea who did it or didn't, and he said it on the radio. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Yeah, and the famous idea.
Yeah. I mean, is that incredible? You have just sentenced 9 people to 30 to 100 years in prison, and you admit that you don't have the faintest idea. In other words, it was not proven to you beyond a reasonable doubt, to quote the legal system, that these people committed the crime. I mean, it just, the officials of this system repeatedly make MOVE point that MOVE people are not in prison, have never gone to prison for the accusation of crime or for being criminal. We have always ended up in prison because we are committed MOVE members, committed revolutionaries. And that's all it was about. Malmet, you know, convicted and sentenced my family to prison because they're committed MOVE members, not because they were guilty of a crime. When I was convicted and sent to prison after the May 13th bombing, that I, you know, am the only adult to survive, it wasn't because I was guilty of any crime. It was because I'm a committed MOVE member. And the parole board basically came out and said that when they demanded that I sever all ties with MOVE, not just me, other MOVE people who have, you know, since done their whole time and maxed out of prison, or after a whole lot of pressure was applied, the parole board had to, you know, end up paroling them. But they put a stipulation on us at first that they would only parole us if we agree to sever all ties with MOVE. Now, I thought I was in prison for, you know, the charge of riot. That's what I was convicted of, okay? But the parole board didn't ask me would I agree not to engage in any demonstrations or riotous activity or anything like that. They asked me and my family, would we leave MOVE, agree to have no contact with MOVE. So, you know, all across the board, repeatedly, whether it's a judge, whether it's a district attorney or the parole board or whatever, the issue has always been our commitment to John Africa, us being MOVE members, not any accusation of crime.
Right, yeah. So what's going on with regards to the case now? I think some members are up for parole. I think other members had been up for parole and the parole was denied. How many times has this happened, the parole hearings being denied?
Since 2008, in the year 2008, my family became eligible for parole because they had completed their minimum sentence,
okay,
30 years.
Mm-hmm.
They had been before the parole board, most of them four times now, some three times, and we'll be seeing them again, you know, sometime this year. The situation now is the parole board demanding that my family admit guilt, you know, say that they're guilty. In other words, lie and say that they're guilty of a crime that they're not guilty of. And a number of things are happening with this. First of all, the parole board has absolutely no right, no authority to demand that my family or anybody say that they're guilty in order to be paroled. Parole does not hinge on guilt or innocence. You've already been convicted or else you wouldn't be in jail going up for parole. You know, the issues concerning parole are supposed to be whether or not you have an acceptable home plan, an acceptable job plan if they require it, what your prison record, you know, has been, like what you've done while in prison, you know, whether you've gotten a lot of misconduct, gotten into a lot of fight or things like that. These are the issues that, you know, are supposed to be considered for parole, not you saying you're guilty. Secondly, do you know how many people have sat in prison for decades, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, only to be exonerated for some reason through DNA testing, through new evidence, somebody coming forward and confessing or whatever, the person actually being innocent, you know? And, I mean, there's a long history of this, of countless people being exonerated, you know, after decades in prison. So with this kind of track record, how in the world does the parole board, any parole board, because it happens across the country, not just in Pennsylvania and not just with MOOP, but across the country, how do these parole boards justify demanding that somebody say they're guilty in order to be paroled? I mean, it's not even legal. Not even legal. What about the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination? And that's if you're guilty. Not to mention, if you're innocent, why should an innocent person have to lie and say they're guilty just to get parole? What is the parole board saying? That we'll release murderers. If somebody confesses to murder, admits to murder, we'll release them. But if a person maintains their innocence and keeps saying that they're not guilty, that they're not a murderer, well, they're going to stay in jail. What kind of sense does that make? People should be outraged. People really should. I mean, I'm outraged, and true, it's my family that's involved, so yes, it is personal. But I'm outraged on a very basic level about this nonsense, that these people feel like they can do this and get away with it, that, you know, they have the right to do this. I mean, this is, it's insane. It's outrageous.
Can you give our audience, you know, tell them something they can do, and maybe call, you know, tell us about, you know, your family, you know, give us their names and tell us something about them, those that are behind bars. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me start with what people can do. What really needs to happen is we need to make an issue of what these parole boards are doing, not just to move, but to numerous inmates, countless inmates across the country. We need to make it an issue whenever we might, you know, happen to have any contact with a parole board member, with these legislators, whether it's state or U.S. legislators. You know, there's a House Judiciary Committee, a Senate Judiciary Committee, and that's on the state level and in the U.S. legislature. These people come around getting in our faces when they want your vote, you know, when they're campaigning for office. They can be in our face all around us. But after they get elected, it's like they don't have time for you anymore. And we need to, you know, demand some face time with some of these officials with issues that we're concerned about. We can't sit back and let them determine what the real issues are, what's important and what's not. We need to let them know what's important to us. You know, we have to make an issue of what's important to us. So that's what we're telling people. We need to make, you know, this an issue, what these parole boards are doing, or else it will continue to happen and it will never be resolved. There will never be an issue that they feel like they have to deal with. So that's one thing that's very important. Another thing is in terms of making an issue of what these parole boards are doing, we need to be in media people's face, journalists' face. We need to be calling in radio talk shows. We need to be writing letters to the editor. We need to be contacting journalists and telling them that they need to be, you know, making an issue of this, that they need to be interviewing and questioning, demanding answers of, you know, these parole boards and these legislators, et cetera. We need to make it an issue.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what people need to do.
Okay. Yeah. And with regards to
Who the Moot Nine is?
Yeah.
Okay. There were four women and five men known as the Move Nine. I'll start with the women. My sister Merle Africa, she was the organization, like, administrator. She kept a log from the very early days of Move. She was one of the first women in the organization, along with my sister Alberta Africa, who was married to John Africa before he was murdered in the bombing. So Merle, you know, she kept logs, she kept newspaper articles. She took down dictation from John Africa when he would speak the guidelines, speak our belief, and she would write it down, and then her or Alberta would type them out later. So that's who Merle was. She got arrested numerous times throughout the years at, you know, peaceful demonstrations that we set up at court cases where moved people were and were attacked by sheriffs and cops, et cetera. So she was a warrior. She was a warrior. Debbie Africa was...
Is Merle still incarcerated? Is she...
I'm sorry. Oh, boy. Merle died in prison. We believe wholeheartedly that she was killed. This was a strong, healthy move woman that worked hard, was physically strong. She, you know, didn't have any problems like, you know, that would cause her to be sick. She got like a stomach virus or stomach flu. Her stomach was upset, but not bad. And she wanted to continue to go to her job, her detail in the prison. And prison officials told her no, that she was getting what was called a lay-in. A lay-in means your status changes and you don't leave your cell for anything except maybe to go to the infirmary if you need to. But you don't go to your job, you don't go to yard out. You don't go to the mess hall for meals. A tray is sent to you at your cell, and that's what they did to Merle, sent her a tray. And that very night, after she got her first tray, Debbie, who was her cellmate, said Merle got up to go to the bathroom, and she didn't hear her come back. She went to check on her, and Merle was passed out on the floor, and they sent for an ambulance to come get her, and the ambulance is like 20 minutes away, according to, you know, prison officials and everybody, but it took them like over an hour to get there, and the next word we got was that Merle had died. That she had died, she had passed away. We know they did something to her. No strong, healthy, you know, move woman just passes away like that. That, I mean, you know, there are some serious questions here. And finally, our position is, anyway, that when they arrested Merle in August of 1978, and she became the custody award of the state, you know, they took responsibility for her. I mean, they took responsibility for feeding her, housing her, clothing her, you know, assigning her to, you know, a work detail. They determined what she would eat, when she would eat, you know, when she went to bed at night, when she got up to go eat breakfast, to go to work or whatever. I mean, they took responsibility for her, Wanda. So anything that is therefore their responsibility. You know, Merle was not at home with her move family, living her belief, you know, eating and living the way she chose to live based on her belief. She was put in a position where somebody else had responsibility for her and dictated how she would live, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's their responsibility.
Right.
Yeah, so Merle passed away in March of 1998, and, you know, we still feel that loss, still feel that loss.
And I guess they don't do autopsies.
Well, they actually do.
Oh.
That's not our belief, but because she was an inmate, the prison said, you know, it's their policy to do autopsies. And we tried to work with Merle's mother because, you know, they recognized her as, you know, the person who would have say-so and responsibility and the next of kin and all of that. So they did an autopsy. And they said Merle died of natural causes.
Wow.
Well, MOVE people were up in arms, and we're saying, what in the world does that mean, natural causes? What are you saying she died of? What are these natural causes you're talking about? When pressed on that, they then said, she had... What did they say? She had, what do you call those, like, lumps you get? Blood clots.
Mm-hmm.
They said she had blood clots in her legs that traveled to her heart. And we were like, we don't believe that. And if that's so, you call that natural causes? That's not natural causes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Then they turned around and said, she had cancer in her ovarian cancer. And we're like, well, what is it? You know? Why is it they keep changing their story? You know? So we don't believe anything that they said. And we do believe that they did something. They did something to her. I mean, if she was willing to go to work and didn't feel that sick, why did they demand that she take a lay-in? Why did they put her on lay-in status, knowing, you know, what all that entails, that she has to stay in her cell and that they bring a tray specifically designated for her? You know, we don't believe anything they say. We know it's something foul that happened there.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I want to let my guest that's waiting let the person know. Sheba, I know that you're there, and we're wrapping it up now, but I wanted Ramona to let our audience know who the MOVE 9 are.
Right.
Yeah.
I was starting to say other members of the MOVE 9 are Debbie Africa and Mike Africa, who Debbie, they're married, husband and wife, and Debbie was 8 months pregnant.
Oh, wow.
In August of 78. She gave birth to a baby boy in September of 78 in the jail cell where she was being held, gave birth to him naturally. He's a strong, healthy, MOVE man. And he was taken from her, I think, like 3 days after he was born because officials did not know that Debbie had given birth to him. For 3 days, she, you know, had him in the cell and breastfed him and kept him with her as long as she could, you know. But after 3 days, you know, they came and got him, officials came and got him, and he was taken from her. And Debbie's mother, Mike Jr.'s grandmother, got, you know, temporary custody of him or custody of him. And Debbie nor Mike have seen their son, who was 33, will be 34 this September.
Wow.
In any way except on a prison visit. in Mike's entire life. He is married, has four children of his own now, and not only has he not seen his parents except on a prison visit in his entire life, his four children have not seen their grandparents in their entire life except prison visit.
Wow.
You know, and that's why this is so urgent with us too. I mean, not only should our people not be in prison because they are innocent, but how many generations, you know, are going to sit back not knowing their family members, not seeing their family members except on a prison visit? Then there's Delbert Africa and Janet Africa, who had a daughter named Alicia, who was killed in the bombing.
Oh, wow, really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Wow. Phil and Janine Africa had a son named Phil, who was killed in the bombing. You know? That's who these people are, people who are committed to what's right, to fighting this ungodly system. And in the process, not only have sat in prison unjustly all these years, but went to prison, leaving children out here who were then murdered by the very system that dares to call them a murderer. You know? The very people that burn their babies alive have the audacity to call MOVE people murderers. And people wonder why MOVE is so bitter, you know, and angry. I mean, we don't go around cussing people out and, you know, attacking people. We don't do that. We conserve our energy to keep fighting this rotten system that is responsible for all of this. But that doesn't mean that we're not bitter and angry, and justifiably so.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Who did I leave out? Oh, then there's Eddie Africa and Chuck Africa, who are two strong, you know, committed MOVE men. Chuck was, let me see, 18 when he went to prison in 78. He is now 52.
Wow.
You know, so he has spent the majority of his adult life in prison, 34 years from the time he was a teenager till now, you know.
Yeah.
Eddie, he is a strong, committed, you know, MOVE man who has children out here that, you know, have been without him for 34 years. He was married. His wife passed away. She was a MOVE supporter. She wasn't a MOVE member, more of a MOVE sympathizer, but, you know, was his wife, died while he was in prison. You know, so, you know, MOVE people have been through a lot, have experienced a lot, you know, and I mean, this is why we are so committed to never give in to this rotten system that is the cause of everything that not only we have been through and continue to go through, but all of the wrong, the injustice, the suffering that all of life goes through, that every single person goes through, and that every animal goes through, all of life goes through, you know? So I'm saying this is no lightweight thing that we're dealing with here. If we don't confront injustice and wrong, when we see it, no matter who it's directed at, then we're endorsing it. We're perpetuating it and, you know, allowing it to fester and to grow and to, you know, affect other people, everybody else, including yourself, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you so much for, you know, for giving us this history and also, you know, letting our audience know how, you know, they can join, you know, the resistance movement to free the Move 9, but also to...
free themselves.
Exactly, and free themselves, and also to address this system, which is unjust for so many people.
Yeah, yeah. In leaving, let me just leave a contact number for any of your listeners that might want to get in contact with us. And that is 215-386-1165.
Okay, say it again one more time.
215-386-1165.
1165. Okay, and then also for people that like email, could you give them the email address too?
Sure. Our email address is on the move, that's onamoveellja at AOL.com.
Okay, all right, cool, super. Well, thank you so much, Ramona, for taking time out to speak to us this April 1st, the first day of Black August. And do you know Sheba Makeda Haven?
I don't
know.
But the name kind of sounds familiar. I might have met her on one of my trips out to the Bay Area.
Sheba?
Hi. Ramona, you know Sister Sheba. How are you doing?
Oh, okay, okay. How you doing?
I'm okay. It's good to hear your voice.
Thank you. Good to hear yours, too. I know you got a lot of information for people.
I'm talking about art today, but I do have a poem for Black August. Maybe Wanda will let me read it later, but I'm talking about art today.
Okay. Okay.
All right, but it was good to hear you remember all nine of the Move 9.
Oh, it's, yeah.
I always think of them as a group rather than individuals, so I'm glad you brought the people out.
Yeah, absolutely. We are a family.
Yes, and those are actual persons, not a concept. They're real people.
I know, I know.
I appreciate that.
Okay, all right. Okay, well, thank you so much, Wanda, for giving me the opportunity to address your audience and speak to them. And thank you also for giving me the opportunity to speak to Sister Sheba. All right, now. Take care. On the move. Stay strong. And long live revolution.
All
right.
Well, my Ramona, love to all. Give everybody
all right.
My love.
Peace and blessings. Sister Sheba, yeah, why don't we... Why don't we start with your poem, and then we'll talk about the Mud Cloth Madness exhibit that's been extended, thank goodness, over at the African American Museum and Library in Oakland. For those who haven't been able to see it yet, it is simply fantastic.
All righty. Well, I wrote a poem for Black August, but it reflects still some stuff that's still happening. I saw a petition yesterday. They want 50,000 signatures for a petition to name who was COINTELPRO in the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they only had, I was number 999, so I'm hoping that people will sign that petition, search for COINTELPRO petition,
mm-hmm.
unless you're one of my Facebook friends, and then it's on my page. And then I also saw that Indiana Okoli had been denied parole again. I work with, I go to a salon later on this morning that our writing prompt today was about pork. So here's my poem, The Pig Within. Way back in the day, we called The Pig Within the cult of the personality. that recurring phenomenon that destroyed organizations, ruined lives, and imprisoned freedom fighters. The pig within, that false dichotomy that made it seem that working for a cause was the same as working for a so-called leader, not because of a belief in a cause, but because of a desire to appear superior to an opponent, more honorable than any ally, better suited to decide matters of policy than any other fellow traveler, and secretly better than the last recollection of the image in the mirror or in the mind of total strangers. That parasite, the pig within, persists today, pops up in obscure places, feeding on the minds of those who would otherwise transform reality without transforming themselves. The only cure for this affliction is the application of corrective principles to distorted perspectives, a rededication to the cause, because the cause is just, and just as tenaciously as crabgrass demands to be brought to fruition. No matter what Big Pharma and the chemicals cartel say, seeds are not intellectual property, and neither are ideas of social justice, economic fairness, freedom, love, and life. They are wild and evolve far beyond the control of those who merely articulate them this time, for they have been here before and will return again, no matter how deeply trampled by the pig within. In memory of fallen comrades and in honor of Black Panther Party political prisoners.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you, Sister Sheba. So I was looking as you were reading The Pig Within. That pig has such a metaphor, isn't it?
And the writing prompt was for the pork, and some of y'all know that I don't eat pork, right? I haven't eaten pork since I was frying pork chops when I found out that Martin Luther King had been shot. I was 16 years old, and I have not eaten pork since then.
Wow.
And even the smell of it takes me back to the moment that I heard that Martin Luther King had been shot, and I'm nauseous. So I don't have a problem about eating pork.
Yeah, that's a real indelible emotional image, that is attached to the swine, to the pig.
Yeah.
And one thinks about, Emory Douglas's work, in creating, that the pig as representative of the American judicial system, through its men in blue, the pig.
And extrajudicial killings, yes.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and then one thinks about, I grew up in the Nation of Islam, and we didn't eat pork. We don't eat pork, and Muslims don't eat pork either, or any of its byproducts. And you think about, sort of the pig being, a scavenger on four legs, similar to, catfish, but not catfish. Catfish is also a scavenger. So anyway, and then one thinks about, do you want to be pig-like? Like, not really. So it's interesting, the pig within. I wanted to ask you if you could tell our audience a little bit more about this petition with regards to COINTELPRO. Some of our audience might not be knowledgeable about, what is COINTELPRO? What is the counterintelligence program? And what does it mean to have, disclosure of the records?
Well, the counterintelligence program started way, way back in the day, long before my poem alludes to, with Marcus Garvey, with the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And it was set up by J. Edgar Hoover in 1927 or 28, something like that, to destroy, supposedly it was supposed to first destroy organized crime, but the only thing that it actively worked towards for most of its existence was to destroy the aspirations of Black people and other people of color to have full rights as citizens in the United States. And then later it expanded to include anybody that was anti-war. And what they did was they planted informants, they to infiltrate organizations, to either act as agent saboteurs or to foment plots that would get people locked up. And so that they were opportunistic, like the people we were talking about earlier. And really, they did a lot of damage. Their first informant was a black man whose name I forget, who actually stabbed Marcus Garvey in the offices after the idea came about to buy stock in a steamship, actually sell stock in the Black Star steamship line. So it's been around a long time, and it's the methodology of infiltration, misdirection, and it existed for the Black Panther Party to discredit, to destroy, and to prevent the rise of a black messiah. That was its stated purpose.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And you, you're a member of the United Negro Improvement Association, Marcus Garvey's organization, the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, whose birthday is coming up on August 17th, and we've had many special broadcasts, and you were on the one more recently last year, and we're going to do another one this year, so hoping that you are available. And you're also a member of the African Orthodox Church. I don't know your title. What's your title?
I'm a deaconess.
A deaconess, right, yeah. And you are a wonderful jewelry maker. Your work, your jewelry is beautiful, and it's also medicinal because you work in these healing stones and
it's
metals, and they all sort of come together. If a person asks you to make them something that sort of fits in with what you're looking for around health and well-being as well as beauty, I think that's really cool because I wear my bracelet every single day, the one with those. I don't even remember the name of the stones, but because people are like, oh, you're wearing blah blah blah, and I'm like, okay, that's nice. which what am I? The one I wear all the time, the brown one.
The teacher's stone. Mm-hmm. It's because you're an instructor, you wear the teacher's stone.
Right.
Yeah, it's serene. But I call it the teacher's stone because it's about being fair, but also being in charge. And I really, and also being willing to try new things.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I really like that stone.
Yeah, and since I've been wearing it now for about a year. And it's really funny because I've been wearing white, so I don't wear the necklace as a necklace. I wear the necklace around my wrist. So it's like, and then sometimes I wear the bracelet and I wear the necklace around my wrist. So I like wrap it a few times. So it's like I'm like carrying super duper teacher fairness and in charge power. Yeah, and then also, you know, you work in iron. I'm like, how many jewelers work in iron? And it's like, and it's so it's durable, and it's like iron is within itself. You think about sort of the medicinal qualities of that metal.
Yeah, because so you will absorb some of the iron through your skin if you're anemic, and I'm a testimony to that myself from having overcome anemia, but also it's a symbol of justice. So iron is supposed to be good for success in lawsuits. So yeah, I've been using some of that lately, and I've been using it for a long time. I call my jewelry design nouveau retro, and that old new old.
Okay.
It's also an illusion. You know, we have these double entendres and triple entendres. It's also an allusion to Art Nouveau, which brings us to my contribution to the Mud Cloth Madness. I hope that that Marshall will be able to call in and talk to you more about the Mud Cloth Madness, because that's Marshall Bailey who got me involved in that show. And just as so many of you in the Bay Area and the Black writers and artists, local SIPs have encourage me and each other to expand as artists. Marshall Bailey here in Sacramento encouraged me to expand as an artist and invited me to participate in the Mud Cloth Madness show. And I did a lamp inspired, it's sort of a tribute both to Lewis Comfort Tiffany, because he did all those art lamps, and also as Marshall, like Betty Starr, is an assemblage artist. Mm-hmm. So if you saw my lamp, you saw those influences.
Yeah, the lamp is just beautiful. From the lamp cover to the lamp itself is just beautiful.
Influence of Lewis Comfort Tiffany, because he made the whole lamp of one thing. The whole experience of the lamp was as a piece of art. Both the lamp stand, which most people just made a passion artistic kind of thing to, and the lamp shade. Because mostly we think of lamps as utilitarian, but in that Art Nouveau and then later in the Art Deco movement, and then on to the 60s, the lamp shade had a great opportunity for artistic expression. And only the law of the lamp was the thing where the whole lamp itself was, and no shade was the expression. And then back in the 70s and the 80s, we went back in 90s and 2000s, except for Reminiscing, we went back to the lamp as a utilitarian kind of object.
Yeah. So describe your lamp to our audience, because this is an audio medium, so they can't necessarily see it. Talk about, because Kente mud cloth, I should say, from the description and also from the various ways the artists interpret the work. I don't know how many artists are there in the collective that participated.
I don't know. I think there was. I know there. It felt like there were over 40 pieces when I saw the show in Sacramento. And it ranges from everything from wall hangings to art quilts to multimedia pieces. There's one really nice piece I like that's done in in plexiglass, which is really nice, that incorporates some of the Andika symbols and some of the symbols of the cowries. A lot of us use cowries that symbolize prosperity, and they're also symbols of Oshun in West Africa, symbolizing love. So most of them reflect the idea, most of the work reflects the idea of spirituality, love, whether it's familial or romantic love, and or love of nature. And also the ideas of spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
So mine is called Toes Amongst the Lilies. And it's a lamp that I found two of in the SPCA thrift store. And I covered the base of it with mud cloth and polymer clay tiles and lapis lazuli. So the base of the lamp is columnar slats that are covered with a gold-colored mud cloth. And they represent sort of like reeds by the side of a stream, as it's toes amongst the lilies. And you'll see the toes in the polymer clay tiles. You sort of see their eyes. They're sort of abstracted out. And the lapis lazuli, it's for healing and intuition. So that's the watery part of it. It's little, rectangular lapis lazuli beads that are laid on their sides to be like a mosaic of lapis lazuli. That's on the base of the lamp. And then I got this really nice piece of fabric. It's from Ivory Coast, and it's for a really dressy outfit. But it's blue, so it's like the background of water. And if you see this lampshades, you'll know that I've done a lot of cooking. So I appliqued some fish swimming on there and gave some little mud cloth plants with mother of pearl flowers and buds to eat.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of fun with that.
Mhm. Yeah, I was wondering, since the curator is not with us, if you could tell us a little bit about the whole term mud cloth, which is a handmade Malian cotton fabric, traditionally mm-hmm. dyed with fermented mud. And I remember when I was in Mali visiting shops with various pieces of mud cloth and the different designs. They have different designs. They also have different colors. People are probably more familiar with the brown and the white, mm-hmm. but there are other colors. And they were talking about, on the various plates at the exhibit, I read about, different backgrounds, like, the orange and the red, and some were like preparation for war, and then there's the blue. And I was wondering if you know anything about the Bogolan or mud cloth and its, mm-hmm. its meaning and how it's made, or, do you know anything about it?
I know somewhat, but mine is sort of limited. I know that Marshall knows a lot more than I know. I like Bogolan finally because of the way that it's made. That was one of the things that struck me when I first found out about it. It's woven by the men. It's strip weaving, and then it's sewn together. But the resist is the patterns that are put in it are done by women. So the division of labor that requires both male and female to complete one piece of fabric, I thought that was just wonderful. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing about, and like you said, it is dyed with fermented mud. So you can't wash it. So it automatically becomes this piece of fabric that you cherish. Because mm-hmm. if you wash it, you'll wash out the mud, right? So, as I found out, unfortunately, one day. But you automatically cherish it, and you either steam or dry clean it so that it tends to become an heirloom object automatically. There are different symbols that are present in the mud cloth that to our untrained first just appeared as like abstract. But and see, I know Marshall can describe these, so I also sent him a text message. Hopefully he'll call in. He has charts that he publishes, and if they can go to the museum, they can check out those charts, and they can go online mm-hmm. and look up mud cloth or Bogolan Fani, Bogolan Fani, and get a lot of information. We're blessed to have so many scholars of African textiles. So, yeah, I really like mud cloth. I tend to hoard mud cloth because I have older mud cloth. After people like Diane von Furstenberg and Liz Claiborne and them discovered African textiles, I guess you could say if you're a, quote, purist, close quote, that the medium got polluted or distorted. But then that's the thing about fabric, even if it because so many traditional fabrics, whether we're on the African continent or in Northern Europe or Eastern Europe or South America, the fabric is descriptive of place, time, social status. And for me, it's really interesting to not only use fabric, but to study fabric and the social stuff that it's a part of.
Yeah, I was wondering. I was thinking, particularly when I see the blue mud cloth and those designs, it sort of reminds me of patterns of cloth here in the United States in the South. I was thinking about the Georgia Sea Islands in particular. And also the Carolinas, you think about the bluing, that particular process. Yeah, Ndingo. Yeah, Ndingo. And I was wondering if you know, since you're, you know, you're an artist and you know a whole lot about a lot of things, if you know about sort of the connections between you know, the Ndingo, you know, type of patterns and colorings and you know and the mud cloth and those particular symbols that one sees on the cloth.
That's really, really basic stuff. Like, I actually know more about Adinkra symbols, the funeral symbols,
mm-hmm.
than I know about the Bogolan Fani symbols. But the indigo is a plant from West Africa. And that's why it grows so well in the Carolinas, and that's why so many of the people, the former slaves, know how to prepare the indigo. And it takes 3 years to prepare indigo as a dye. You have to grow it. You got to harvest the roots. Then you got to boil it with iron oxide and strain it and ferment it and do all this stuff to it. It takes 3 years to get a batch. You know, so that it's a technology on its own. Even though it's a vegetable dye, vegetable dyes generally don't come lightly. Plus, then you got to use I don't remember, the mordant is the substance that makes the dye stay in the fabric, and I don't remember what that is. But when I first found out about indigo, I was in high school, and I wanted to reject the idea of the blue jeans as being European. Come to find out, who invented denim and indigo and the old dye thing was us.
Wow, that is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. With satin, with brocade, and with velvet. I'm thinking these are European fabrics, and they come straight out of Angola.
Hmm.
Right? So I'm like, I really need to find out more about fabric, and I've just been so fascinated with so much of it that I only know a little teeny bit about a lot of different ones to get this picture that fabric is a real technology. You have to have peace to make fabric. You can't be busy making fabric in the middle of a war. So that's why it hurts my heart that's not the only reason, but that's one of the reasons, the destruction of Timbuktu and everything else. But
yes,
fabric is going to suffer in Mali.
Hmm.
The same thing, there was a beautiful fabric that I got like maybe 40 or 50 yards of from Gabon that was a traditional plaid, you know, and then Gabon went to war for 20 years, you know. So that you lose a lot of history, but fabric can persist and recall some of that history if there's elders that survived these conflicts. And then hopefully it'll be preserved and brought about again. And I would tell you, ironically, most of what I learned about fabric, I learned courtesy of the British Museum. In terms of African textiles, and then I just have to add to it, because a lot of the African fabrics, especially from West Africa, from those British colonies, are in the original pieces before the European contact, are in the British Museum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I looked up the meaning of mud cloth online, and it says that, you know, as we were talking, that each piece of cloth has a story to tell. And the symbols and the way in which they are arranged, as well as the color and shape of the mud cloth, reveal a variety of different secrets. Social status, a person's character, or occupation are all things which a piece of mud cloth can represent. And there are many African proverbs and other items of historic significance which are commonly portrayed in the mud cloth as well. And even now, many people in Africa are very careful about what they wear, as each fabric, color, and dress has its own meaning. And I was speaking to Louisa Teach, and she was telling me, because I was telling her that when I went to Rufus, there was some, there's some designs that I wanted made, and she was saying, but it just didn't happen. And she was saying that, you know, there are certain, certain designs, certain colors that one cannot wear. You just can't walk in off the street and say, I want this or I want that, that it has to do with a particular society or particular community,
yeah,
or particular place you are in the hierarchy of that community. You know, that's what these clothes and that what this fabric symbolizes. And so what we're saying about mud cloth, it also pertains to other types of garments and clothing and fabric.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, it's mud cloth is what this exhibit is about. But the philosophy around this cloth, it permeates African, culture in general.
Yeah. And you'll notice the mud cloth that I used, which was like a serendipitous thing, was mm-hmm. that I had some mud cloth that was full of stars, so I felt very comfortable putting it on a lamp,
Right, yeah. And it's really cool. The Mud Cloth Madness art exhibit created by the Kaumba Collective Art Gallery, which is in Sacramento. They're located at 1001 Del Paso Boulevard, number 1A in Sacramento. And you can call the curator. His number is 916-613-0099. And or you can email him at DEANERO, or I'm not going to even try to say it, 2002 at yahoo.com. But at the African American Museum and Library, the exhibit, which opened in June, is closing, I believe it's going to be closing Tuesday, August 6th. So you've got an extra day because the museum libraries close on the Monday. So you can catch it this weekend, today through the weekend, and then you can see the exhibit again on Tuesday before the exhibit, I guess, goes on its next stop on the tour. And the African American Museum and Library, or AAMLO, AAAMLO, is located at 659 14th Street at Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Oakland. And the phone number there is area code 510-637-0200, 510-627-0200. And the museum library is open Tuesday through Saturday from 12 to 5:30. And the website is currently not working, so you don't need to go visit it right now. There's some technical stuff happening there. But it's a beautiful exhibit, and Sister Sheba's lamp is just one of many beautiful pieces. There are sculptures that are draped in kente. There are these wonderful paintings that have mud cloth incorporated within the design. I mean, mm-hmm. there are these staffs that one can use when one goes to war or to battle. I think they're symbolic now, but they look like they could have been useful.
and I think that you can still use them if you have a battle.
Yeah, and then there are these beautiful mud cloth hats. They're like, ooh, yes, really beautiful. And it's just really gorgeous. And then the type of mud cloth that's used in the various by the various artists, it varies. I mean, you don't see the same mud cloth used it's all different. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I wanted to say one thing is because some of the artists were originally from the Bay Area, but not all of them. Every artist was so excited to be sending work to Oakland. I don't think Oakland recognizes sometimes that it's also viewed as a center of Black culture on the West Coast. So everybody was just so thrilled and so excited to be sending a group show to Oakland as the first stop on the tour. So that, one mind, y'all, And much love to the my brothers and sisters in Oakland.
Oh, wow. No, I didn't know that.
that was the big excitement that we're going to do this tour, and it's going to start in Oakland. Yay!
Wow.
So there's a lot of love in the world for the city of Oakland.
Yeah. Wow, that's awesome. Well, you have definitely made some serious history in Oakland, you know, as a member of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, and your work, around the testing for sickle cell and helping in the establishment.
I was not alone. Oakland by itself has its own much respect and love.
Oh yes, I know. But you're a part of, you know, why Oakland,
yes,
you know, is what it is. Yeah, around the consciousness aspect of it, you know, looking at the nouveau retro, right? So this is like we're looking at the retro now. The retro is Sister Sheba, Makeda Hayden, and, you know, the poet, the woman who, sort of established, some of the wonderful institutions that people are not aware date back to, you know, Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, looking at, you know, healthcare, particularly for people that do not have medical coverage, and looking at these community clinics like, you know, the one in West Oakland. Why don't you talk a little bit about some of your work around, some of these institutions that you were instrumental in developing?
Well, I was a lieutenant in the Black Panther Party, and like I said, that idea is much larger than me. I'm just very glad that I got to participate in it. The Black Panther Party started two clinics. I think the first one was in Chicago, and you'll remember the shootout that killed Fred Hampton. The head of their clinic was wounded in that shootout. We called him Doc. But they had started with the idea that was radical at the time of preventive health. Unfortunately, some of the problems that we faced then, we still face now in terms of high blood pressure, heart disease, substance abuse, and venereal diseases in terms of preventable disease. And then in terms of infectious disease, we all still have these to address that, and diseases of malnutrition, which I guess you could put diabetes in and high blood pressure back into those diseases of malnutrition. So it was part of a overall strategy that the three clinics were a tactic in the overall strategy of survival in terms of economic justice in a capitalist system. The thing that I think I most benefited from was the idea that that was expanded upon, but that was introduced again. You know, we all ride in, as they say, on the shoulders of giants. The Nation of Islam introduced the idea of do for self and the idea of proper nutrition, and to take what was good from the, quote, slave diet and leave what was trash alone from the slave diet. So we also, in addition to giving away food, we had the free clinics. We gave away vitamins and first aid kits, and we did maternal health care. And so I'm just really happy that some of that stuff is coming up in the affordable health care, even though single payer would be much nicer. You're seeing that today they're implementing some of the women's health care stuff. So that's great. And then you have the same forces that endured slavery for so long, saying that parts of the women's health care should be illegal, actually. So it's interesting that these struggles get reintroduced on, like, cycles of 20 years. So for me, that's why it's valuable to understand the history of the UNIA and then how that got beat down. And 20 years later, here we come back to the Nation of Islam and El-Hajj Malik al-Shabazz, and then in a continuum where there wasn't a void in that 20 years, the Black Panther Party started. Mm-hmm. So that, and then now, 40 years, we had a void for like 40 years. Now we have the Occupy movement, but it only appears to be a void because constantly people are working to improve their communities. And I think that the idea of do for self is probably one of the most powerful ideas, and that is just carried through and was enhanced by the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And I believe I got an email speaking about how we need to, Black people in particular, need to learn first aid as well as CPR, because when someone is, you know, has an emergency, particularly a cardiac arrest, and you know, in public, you know, it's really, first responders are really important, and it's crucial that we know, you know, first aid and CPR, so that, you know, we can save each other, you know, in these kind mm-hmm. of instances. Yeah, because this man, when I went to the event this past weekend with Amiri Baraka, and he was in conversation with Reginald Workman at Eastside Arts Cultural Center, and the topic was mm-hmm. looking at Black arts and jazz in particular, and where we are now as a community, you know, when, you know, much of our creativity is being appropriated. And everybody's making money on it as usual, rather than us. And so there was this man, black man, who was on the ground across the street in front of this store that was open. And so, you know, I think he might have been inebriated because there was an unopened can of beer under him, but he couldn't get up. I mean, he just was rolling around on the ground. And I'm like, let me call the ambulance for him. And so then when I left him after the ambulance was on his way, I went into the store to tell the people in the store that I had called for an ambulance. And I said, there's this man on the ground. And she said, oh, he's always, you know, he always does. He's always down there. You know, he always, you know, we find him on, you know, in front of our store often. I'm like, well, that's not a good thing. You know, it's like there's something going on that's not being addressed, that this person keeps on appearing in front of your store, you know, on the ground passed out or barely conscious.
Mm.
And it was just amazing how everybody kept on, like, nobody called. Everybody, I mean, there were, like, a lot of people. It wasn't, like, late. People driving by, people crossing the street. Nobody stopped to take care of this man. I'm like, wow, that's – and so I told him, you know, that I call for help, and you know, obviously, you know, getting, you know, dried out, as they say, you know, is not going to help him because there's a deeper issue going on there.
Needs
addressing.
So that is one thing that we did not address in the clinic was mental illness very often attendant substance abuse. Most mm-hmm. many people had a dual diagnosis. That's one thing I was introduced to greater work through another old Panther community worker, was Zenobia Embry Nimmer, and we did a lot of work together around homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks to Ronald Reagan as the governor of California, when he closed many of the mental institutions, they never implemented the community care that was needed to deal with that huge influx mm-hmm. of homeless people who were truly helpless because they had also mental illness. And to self-medicate, they used alcohol and other drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So that there is a great deficit in the Black community, partially through stigma and partially through lack of resources. And even though we have many trained clinicians in psychology and psychiatry,
mm-hmm.
we're loath to employ them because there's a stigma around mental illness. Even depression is stigmatized. So you're talking to a therapist, oh my, you may as well admit that you're shooting heroin to some people as to say that you're in therapy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that that's like a preventable tragedy that we can address if we would. I'm so glad that we're finally addressing the idea of HIV transmission, but I remember 30 years ago when I was working in a private AIDS clinic, there were many people that asked me, why was I helping those homosexuals? I was like, this is a sexually transmitted disease. You don't think you're going to get it? I'm sorry to tell you. Any disease that's sexually transmitted affects everyone who has sex. It doesn't mean that everyone is going to get HIV, but it means that the government is lying when they tell you you have to be a drug abuser or a prostitute or practice voodoo to get HIV. That's just propaganda on its face.
Yeah, so, but also a lot of people, you know, also got the disease. You know, some children got it because, you know, they got it from their mothers when they were coming through the birth canal, or, you know, someone got a blood transfusion and the supply was contaminated. So, there are a lot of ways that people could have gotten infected that have now, there's a lot of safeguards now around maternal child transmission. You know, it's been basically almost eliminated, and also the blood transfusion, virtually eliminated now. But still, the sexual transmission of the disease.
Even with mother-to-child transmission, there was like a five-year battle just to get the testing of all pregnant women in the state of California. I don't know how long it took for the rest of the country, but just to get pregnant women tested for HIV as part of their
routine
prenatal testing. Yeah, it was like you're implying that these women are immoral. Well, how does a disease have a morality attached to it, except through propaganda? So that we got to get past some of the propaganda about mental illness. We have to override the stigma with the idea that actually people can get well if they're attended to, that their issues actually can be addressed. And then we got to make sure that they're addressed humanely.
The cultural competence, you know, with regards to clinicians is definitely important when one is looking at wellness. And you're right. I mean, there are so many people of African descent going into the field. April, who was on earlier, you know, talking about her artwork that's at the San Francisco Main Library, that looks at the legacy of slavery globally through these wonderful boxes that she's created, these beautiful art boxes. She's going into doing graduate work in psychology, and I was just at the I'm not sure if it was the 34th annual, but the ABCI or the Black Psychologist Conference, and they're like a lot of them across the country. There are so many Black folks thinking about and working in Black mental health. I mean, if everyone who needed help could get it, we'd be well, because there are so many people that are doing the work, but they're not necessarily accessible because you know, people don't have money, or you know, this particular plan doesn't cover it, and or maybe even they just don't know where these clinicians are to be able to get the kind of support, psychological and spiritual support, because they go hand in hand, to be well.
Yeah. Well, and you're right, that does bring us full circle. That's the role, that's part of that is the role of cultural workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm down for participating in any art auction, either with jewelry or some of the craft or fine artwork that I do. that will help to fund some of those programs through our own community so that we're not dependent on people who don't give a.
Right. Yes. You know, it's all about establishing these institutions, because if we have the institution, then people will find us. You know, we can do marketing because we can say, okay, you know, this particular address, this is what this what we do here. You know, and you don't have to have money. It's, you know, it's about wellness. So, you know, if you have the money, then cool, we'll bill you. If you don't worry about it, because it's all about wellness. And if you need housing, that's connected to the program. You know, if you need education, that's connected to the program. If you need employment, well, hey, we have things you can do here. You know, we've got the community garden, we've got the this, we've got the that, and we've got training if you want to be trained, if you want to go to school and further your education, and then get into, you know, developing some kind of business that you might be thinking about, because it's not about jobs, it's about entrepreneurship, you know, creating, you know, work, you know, that fills a need in our community. All that could be taken care of in our institutions, you know? So we need to get moving. Mary Barack said, where are our theaters? You know, how come we're not showing movies in our communities? Where are our theaters? where are our museums? You know, there should be a museum in every major city in this country.
Well, the Black museums are small, but they're present. So, so again, I agree with you. Go out and support that every show at the African-American Museum in Oakland. Bye-bye.
Yeah, well, cool. Well, thank you so much, Sheba, for joining us, and I look forward to talking to you on Marcus Garvey's birthday. We're going to do a special again.
I don't have to get out my notes.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's a special birthday celebration for Elder. Did you get that?
For Elder Freeman?
Yeah, they're going to be doing something special for him this month. I need to.
Wonderful.
I'll send it to you. It's going to be at Eastside Arts. We're going to be honoring him. And I know he's your buddy. Y'all both, you know. You're
brother.
A deacon. And is he a deacon too? Or?
No, he is a priest.
He's a priest. Okay.
Yes.
All righty. He's a priest in the Church of St. John Coltrane, right?
Yes, one mine in the African Orthodox Church.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Awesome. Well, that is so cool. You have a great time at your
the salon that I'm getting ready to go to. One month.
That sounds really great. And thank you so much for sharing that great poem with us. That's just, you know, fresh off the off the presses, so to speak. The pig was in.
I finished it yesterday. You know how you chew on stuff for a couple of weeks, but I finished it yesterday.
All right, you take good care. Have a great day.
Well, mine.
Okay, peace and blessings. And I want to also let our audience know that that there is a the One Life Institute is having its Spirit Sound and Silence Retreat on Saturday, the 4th of this month. And so it's an all-day retreat, and I am, as I speak, I'm looking and not finding the information. But it's One Life Institute, and again, it's the Spirit Silence and Sound Retreat. And Destiny, Harpers for the Hood, is going to be performing as a part of the Afro Solo Jazz in the Gardens, and that's from 1 to 3 on Saturday as well at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts Gardens, and that's a third admission, and it's a free concert. And Sakash Killian Zillions is going to be performing, and Destiny Harpers for the Hood is going to be performing with a special guest, trumpeter Eddie Gale. So that's going to be really special. So I think that might be where you're going to find me on Saturday, because that is going to be such a special concert. And Art and Soul is going to have a different configuration this year. It's going to be starting at 2 and going until midnight. So you're going to miss the Frederick Douglass Youth Ensemble if you go check out Destiny. But Art and Soul is going to be continuing again. It's going to have a later time this year. They're going to try it out and see how that works. And so that should be pretty interesting. So you don't want to miss, once again, the wonderful exhibit at the Oakland Museum, which is closing, unfortunately, April Martin Chartrand's exhibit, Treasured Cigar Box, Assemblage Explorations of the African Diaspora. And again, that's going to be closing on August 2nd, which is tomorrow. And the exhibit is located on the third floor in the Afro-American Wing at 100 Larkin Street at Grove in San Francisco. And the phone number for the San Francisco Public Library, the main branch, is 415-557-4277, 415-557-4277. And the website is sfpl.org, sanfranciscopubliclibrary.org. And the library is open until 8 o'clock tomorrow, and I believe it's open to 8 o'clock today. So, yeah, you can go check it out, and it will be up, and it is up. And then we were speaking to Sister Sheba about the Mud Cloth Madness exhibit created by the Kaumba Collective Art Gallery in Sacramento, and I gave you the address. And that's up through, it's been extended through Tuesday. So you can check it out today, tomorrow, and through Saturday, and then it closes on Tuesday the 7th, so you don't want to miss that. I guess that's it. I opened the show with a wonderful piece by Babatunde Lee, and the piece is called African Tapestry. And I was thinking, I just sort of felt called to play this piece from Sankofa. But then I was just looking at Ademu's piece, Wolf Hawk Jaguar, and I really like that piece too. Let me see. Maybe I'll play a couple of pieces. So I'm going to play Spirit of the Dead, Rise Up, and then if there's some more time, I'll play a couple of more pieces. Have a wonderful, wonderful Wednesday. Ramadan Mubarak to all those who are fasting. And the moon is full and is looking gorgeous out there in the sky. Peace and blessings. Oh,
from Alabama to some, up to the Cape of Louisiana. Come out, you African spirits, step out and claim stories. You'd slave bred, straighted, burned, barred, and leathered, red, chopped, lobotomized, bound and dead. You African spirit of the dead, rise up, lingering spirit of the dead.
Blessings on the new journey I've been given as I doorsteps. Listening to sounds of salvation, blessings, the answers I need you've been given for the fire aisle.
Wicked. I went into the show with Shoshana Dean, and each night I'd hear Shoshana sing this song. I'd like to do it for you now. Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back to sleep. It's time I trust my instincts, close my eyes, and leave. It's time to try. I think I'll try defying gravity, and you can't hold me down. I'm through accepting limits because someone said they're so. Some things I can never change, but till I try, I'll never know. So tired of being afraid of losing love I thought I had lost. Well, if that's love, it comes at much too high a cost. I'd rather buy defying gravity. Yes, I will try defying gravity, and you can't hold me down. Unlimited. My future is unlimited. And I've just had a vision, almost like a prophecy. Oh, I know. This may sound crazy, and it's true, the vision is hazy. But I swear, someday I'll be up in the sky, defying gravity. By gravity, and you can't hold me down. You can't hold me down. No. So if you can't find me, look to the western sky. As someone told me lately, everyone deserves a chance to fly. And if I'm flying solo, at least I'm flying free. To those who try to ground me, take a message back from me and tell them I'm defying gravity. Come take my hand. We can defy gravity. Oh, let's be free and defy gravity. You too can fly and defy gravity, and I'll match you in renown. And nobody in all the world, nobody in all this world is ever
that was Ben Vereen singing Defying Gravity, and before that we had Wolf Hawk Jaguar doing a piece from his latest work, and I'm looking for the name. he actually called the name of it when he was singing, and I'm looking for it for you. I'm not seeing it. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, but it's on Wolf Hawk Jaguar, and it's a really wonderful, wonderful album. I'm going to have him on to talk about it now that it's out. Adimu Majun is the artist, Wolf Hawk Jaguar. Hopefully you're able to catch him. He's a regular part of the company of the Lower Bottom Players, and they just closed their last production. I think they were doing Ma Rainey's Black Bottom at the Thea Bowman Theater in West Oakland. And prior to that, we had the Spirit of the Dead Rise Up, and that was from Sankofa. Alrighty. So we will hope you will tune in on Friday for another edition of Wanda's Picks, and that's 8 o'clock Pacific time. Until then, be well and try to catch some of these great art exhibits that we were talking about today with our guests, as well as doing something to bring bring the legislators as well as the judicial system, make them aware that this current system of justice is unjust, specifically around what's going on with the Move 9, but just in general. One needs to call attention, confront injustice and wrongdoing. If we don't do that, Ramona Africa says, then we are enabling a system if we don't call attention to its inequities. All righty. Peace and blessings.